I talked about some work I did earlier in the year, late spring, early summer, I guess, with Dario Martelli, who's another postdoc at Imperial. I think I also get a chance to tell you about some work I'm doing now, a bit later. So I should also say that there's been a lot of interest recently in flux complexifications of string theory and M theory. So I'm going to focus on M theory in particular and eight manifolds. But the techniques and general framework I'll discuss actually applies to any theory. So if you're interested in turning on fluxes, you might be interested in more, even if not the specific details. Well, it's been known for a long time, but if you have bosonic supersymmetric solutions to supergravity theories, and you turn off everything, all the fluxes and the gauge fields and so on, then supersymmetric solutions are described by a special form of the manifold. So this arises because supersymmetry implies that there's a covariantly constant spinner, eta, so this connection here is the Levi-Civita connection, and then this statement implies that the manifold has a special form. So examples of that are very well known. Glauber-Yau, multiplications, G2 manifolds more recently, and I started off doing work on spin 7 manifolds. So there are many reasons why turning on fluxes is desirable. So here's a short list. So fluxes can stabilize moduli, so usually in conjunction with non-perturbative effects and so on. Fluxes can also break supersymmetry, which is interesting. If you want to describe wrapped or integrating brain solutions, then since the brains are sources of fluxes, you have to consider solutions of fluxes. Also, the ADS-CFT correspondence, supergravity backgrounds and the ADS-CFT correspondence have fluxes. So there are many motivations for thinking about this. So I'm going to focus on 11-dimensional supergravity in particular. So in general, the Killing-Spinner equation, which is this, involves fluxes. So in M theory, we have this equation for supersymmetry, where G here denotes the fourth order of dimensional supergravity. So one interpretation of this equation, which I'm not going to discuss, is that it's a parallel transport equation for a generalized connection. So by here, I mean you take this term and you shove it inside here and make a generalized connection, say, Nabla hat, which involves this piece. And because there are 5 gamma nations and 3 gamma nations here, it means that that connection is not a connection on spin bundle. It's actually a connection on the Clifford bundle. So the Clifford bundle is just the bundle of that's generated by the Clifford algebraic, i.e. All the gamma nations. And the holonomy of that connection lies in SL32R. So this was work done by Chris Hull.
Also, why is there no connection on spin bundle?
Because a connection on the spin bundle would have 2 gamma nations.
Odd number of gamma nations. Is that the problem?
Yeah, well, gamma matrix is not equal to 2.
I see.
This potentially leads to a classification in terms of subgroups of SL32R. Classify homologies. So you could think of this as analogous to classifying Riemannian manifolds into Kähler Calabrian. So these have different homologies. So that's one approach. But I'm going to explain a different approach, which is more practically useful. Useful for actually looking at solutions and constructing solutions. So the basic idea is that supersymmetry means that I have a killing spinner. So I use Killing spinner quite generally. It just means a spinner that satisfies the appropriate supergravity equation. And that means that there's a stabilizer group of that spinner, G, inside spin N. So I'm on an n-dimensional. So there's a nice morphism between the spin bundle tensor itself and the exterior algebra. So this is just a fancy way of saying that if you take two spinners and you sandwich them between some other matrices, you get a differential form. So if I put a G invariant spinner, then I've also got a whole bunch of G invariant forms. So you can then study and classify solutions with fluxes in terms of something called the intrinsic torsion of this G structure. So the G structure you can think of as just this set of G invariant forms that you construct in the spinner. And physically, this intrinsic torsion is a precise way of measuring the deviation from a special homology. So if you think of having a special homology manifold and turning on some fluxes, or perhaps wrapping some brains or something, then those fluxes or brains will back react on the geometry, and it will no longer have special homology. This intrinsic torsion is a precise way of measuring what that back reaction is. So that's one point I want to emphasize. And the second point is the relation of this to generalized calibrations. So again, this is a simple physical explanation. In that if you put a supersymmetric brain in one of these generalized backgrounds, supersymmetric backgrounds with fluxes turned on, then they saturate a bound on their energy, and this is a calibration bound. So I'll explain what that means later. And this is very closely related to this intrinsic torsion and G structures. So so here's a summary of the general picture. So the supersymmetry equations are related to these generalized calibrations, and those are physically related to minimizing the energy of some wrapped brains. And then I won't say so much about this, but these supersymmetry equations can also be thought of as extremizing some superpotential in low energy theory. So I'll say a bit about that. So as an illustration of what I just said, I'm going to focus on M theory on eight. But I should emphasize that you can do this with any theory. So I should begin by reviewing what was known about M theory on eight manifolds until we looked at this. So I'm interested in compactifications M theory down to three dimensions on an eight manifold, which preserves some supersymmetry, so minimal supersymmetry. And I can therefore make the ansatz where I write the 11 metric to be some 3 metric here, which is either the Minkowski 3 space or ES 3. And then a 8 manifold is here, so this is completely unconstrained at the moment. And this is a wall factor, so this depends only on this metric here. And the ansatz for the flux, which is compatible with preserving symmetry in three-dimensional space, is I have a volume 3 piece from here, wedged with a 1 form. So this, in other words, the flux has a leg inside here, and then an internal piece. So you then decompose the 11-dimensional spinner into three-dimensional parts and three-dimensional parts. And you also notice that there's a chirality operator in 8 dimensions, which squares to 1. So I can therefore decompose my spinner here into positive and negative chirality with respect to this amount. So in the literature so far, people looked at it as the Rebecca's quite a few years ago, took the case that this spinner is chiral, so either one of these vanishes. Okay. So in terms of stabilizing, the stabilizer of this is spin 7 inside spin 8. So it then turns out, quite straightforwardly, that if you rescale the spinner by appropriate power of the warp factor, and you rescale the conformal transformation of the metric, then the supersymmetry conditions imply that this rescaled metric has spin 7 on this equation. And also, these people will be generated. or also, should you can't add a mass to this. So, in fact, I allowed for an alias to be factor here. In fact, this mass here, or 1 over the alias radius, has to be 0. So, continuing with this view, so there's also the flux to worry about. So, in general, then I can decompose the four forms into irreducible representations of spin same, which is what I've done here. And then the supersymmetry tells me that the internal part of the flux on the now spin 7 manifold has to be in the 27, so it has to live inside the. So the solution looks like the following. So this is the general solution when you assume that this internal spinner is hybrid. So there's a warp factor here and here. Here's the Minkowski space. Here's the spin set manifold, and the flux looks like the following. So there's a piece in the R1,2 direction. This leg inside the manifold looks like this, and then here's the 27 part of the flux. And this warp factor and flux are constrained to satisfy this equation here. So XA here is a higher derivative term than the energy reaction. So you can integrate this equation over the 8 manifold, and you get the following tackle equation, which relates the square of the flux to the oil. So if you want to have flux, you'd better have spin 7 manifolds with oil number. Zero. So if you look at the form of these solutions, they look like M2 brains, right? So if I turn off this and the high derivative term, I just get the M2 brain solution. So these can be thought of as M2 brains with a transverse space which has been set. Okay. So if you want more supersymmetry, so if you're interested in Calabi-Yau complexifications, that's very easy. You just complexify the spinner. So now there are two spin 7 structures of the same parallelity, which means the stabilizer for the complex spinner is SU4. And the flux now has to be of type 2,2 and primitive. So I think this is all kind of well known. And so this is also, this flux is also related to a superposition, which was proposed by Sergei Hukov. So in the spin 7 case, the general formula for the superpotential is fluxes wedged with calibration. So I'll come back to calibrations later and how this generalizes. So this object here is just the sandwich of spinners between four and matrices. So it's a four-form wedged with a four-form integrated over the spin 7. So from the point of view of the low energy theory, extremizing the superpotential gives rise to this condition of flux. You set the superpotential to zero and variation with respect to the scale energy. So just as a technical point, this, so people don't generally seem to know this, but this G27 actually drops out of the killing spin. That's what's actually happening. Okay, so that's a very quick review of. So an obvious question is, how else can we obtain supersymmetric vacua in three dimensions apart from this compactification on the spin 7 manifold where you have M2 space filling M2 planes? And what about ADS3? So I told you that ADS3 was ruled out. So what about ADS3 factors? So here's one way of thinking about it. So if you start with M theory on a circle times with the G2 only, and this preserves n equals 2 in three dimensions. But if you now wrap a space-filling M5 brain around a supersymmetric 3-cycle inside the G2 holonomy space, then this breaks half the supersymmetry. So you get an n equals 1 vacuum. And this isn't described by the solutions I just told you, because they're all M2 brain solutions. And in particular, there are R-wrapped supergravity descriptions of graphite grains, which were found by, again, people in London a couple of years ago. So I can now double the amount of supersymmetry and start with M0 on the 2 torus times with the Calabi threefold. This gives me N equals 4 in 3 dimensions. I can now wrap again a 5 grain around a special Lagrange 3 cycle, which is just a supersymmetric cycle inside here. And that gives me N equals 2. And again, this is not in the Calabi fourfold description I just described to you. So there should exist supergravity solutions describing such configurations, but there are supergravity solutions. So the idea here is that the back reaction of the brain or the flux implies that you break special horns. That's what's going on. But as long as you keep supersymmetry, the killing spinner is still there. So the structures, the G2 structure in the first case and the SU3 structure in the second case, are still there. And the failure of the structures to be special polymers is encoded in this intrinsic torsion. So this mathematical construct here is measuring how this back reaction is affected in the solution. Okay, so let me describe that. So the thing to do is just to lift the chirality assumption on the spin. So the stabilizer of this guy here is spin 7 plus, and this one is spin 7 minus, and they intersect over G2. So G2 is the group that stabilizes this. So if you want to describe those situations that I just described, we have 5 brain working cycles. You're going to need to consider the most general type of supersymmetric solution. So now I have a G2 structure, which means I have a set of G2 forms. And they're easy to write down. There's a vector, which you get by sandwiching the plus with minus between the 1 gamma matrix. And I just have normalized this here. And this is like the circle direction when I was thinking of S1 times G2 in the previous transparency. And there's also a three-form I can construct, which is plus with the minus sandwiched between 3. And these are algebraically related to the 2 spin 7. So I can also sandwich plus with plus and minus with minus between 4. And there's an algebraic relation to C, which I didn't know about. So one very interesting consequence of supersymmetry, which seems to be quite a new effect, not studied before, is that these spinners don't have constant norm. So an immediate consequence of supersymmetry is that the norm of these spinners looks like 1 plus or minus sine of some angle, where this is a function on the angle. And then I recover the M2 brain type solutions, by taking the limit that this function is either plus or minus 1, so one of these spinner functions. But in general, this function is turned on. And so this has been referred to as interpolating spinners or something in some way.
Is there a reason why you would make it an angle? Is there a reason why you parameterize it?
Yeah, simply because the sum of... So I've normalized the spinner so that the sum of the two norms is equal to 1. Mm-hmm. So that is fixed. But then the difference, that's where the angle comes in. So in general, the Levi-Civita connection acting on the spinner is not going to be 0, because I turned on fluxes. And roughly speaking, this is the intrinsic torsion here is going to measure the back reaction. So I need to explain to you what this is. So the idea is very simple. You just take this object here and you decompose it into irreducible representations, G2. So to be more precise, if you look in Dominic Joyce's book on his latest book on special homology analysis and so on. He shows that there's always some connection, level of prime, which preserves this spinner. Okay. So the one we're interested in doesn't. There's always some connection, distortion, that it does. So that means that this object here is this minus this actually on the spin. Okay? And now you notice that this thing here is actually a tensor. It's not a derivative operator, it's a tensor. And it lives in one form, so it's got a space-time index here, tensored with spin A. In eight dimensions. So one now defines the intrinsic portion as a component of this tensor, essentially, a set of components of this tensor. So what I do here is I write spin 8 as G2 plus G2 W1. And the intrinsic torsion is the perpendicular part here of this. So the reason that this is this connection is not unique, it needn't be unique. But if there's another connection which satisfies this, the difference of those two connections preserves the spinner. And that means that the ambiguity in the definition of this tensor lives in T star tensor G2. So therefore the perpendicular path is well defined, so hence the intrinsic torsion. And now you just decompose this into irreducible representations of G2, named by Kirby W.
Is that all of this ordinance is just fluxes?
It's just the fluxes. Yeah.
Exactly.
So you know the manifold has G2 homomy if and only if all of these things are working. That's the basic idea.
But not Nabla prime. Just an ordinary spin connection with just two dimensions.
Yeah, but with torsion. Yeah.
Yes. It's not five dimensions.
No, it's not. It's an ordinary connection.
Oh, because five dimensions drop out of the integration because of this additional condition. But if you can see there's a full long derivative with all those products that come back.
Yeah.
So you are saying that products of more than five dimensions.
It's an ordinary, yeah, it exists, but I think there is a formula in Joyce's book, but I don't remember off the top of my head.
So it's not locally equal to G times something.
It's not.
Instead of like algebraically the difference as G times something.
Is G?
No.
The torsion is not algebraically G.
No. Oh. The intrinsic torsion is related to the fluxes, and I'm going to explain this. I'm not finished. Okay, so in this example, so if you just do what I just said, you decompose spin 8 under G2, then the adjoint here of spin 8 decomposes in the following way, 7 plus 7. So that means that the G2 perpendicular here is the 7 plus the 7, because it's the adjoint of G2. So it turns out that there are 10 of these irreducible components here. So here they are. We have two singlets, 4 to the 7s, 2 to the 14s, and 2 to the 8s. And I actually work out this. The remarkable fact is that you can compute all of these components of this intrinsic torsion, which are components of the fluxes, in terms of the exterior derivatives of the forms. So remember that the forms were constructed out of the spinners. So this information here will certainly imply this information here, but the converse is true. So the exterior derivatives of the forms is enough to compute all of these objects. And then supersymmetry determines equations. So I just wrote out the example. I didn't think I'd get this bit. So how do the supersymmetry conditions look in this case? Well, it's a mess. So these conditions here are necessary and sufficient for supersymmetry in the general case. So at first sight, it looks like a horrible mess. Well, I mean, it is. But you can actually, so I group these into 1, 2, 3, and you can analyze each separately. So the first condition here says that I can write the metric in the following way. I can write it as, so here's the three-dimensional part, which is either ADS3 or R1.2. And it means I can split the 8-manifold in the following way. Okay, so this y direction is the k direction. So this is called almost product structure, or k is hypersurface orthogonal, which allows me to write the metric in this form. So I can now forget the first condition, because it's just telling me I can write the metric in this form. So the second components here, you'll notice, do not involve the fluxes. So, k is the vector, remember, this is the warp factor, this is the 3 form. So this here denotes the contraction of the vector into the star. And if you get through these equations, well, actually a little flux appears here, but I can substitute for this equation. So the point is that these do not depend on the fluxes. So these are just constraining the 7-dimensional part of the geometry. And the last two equations are where the fluxes enter. So in particular, this electric part of the flux, where you have a leg inside the internal space, is determined by the structure. And if I take this to the other side, I get F equals something to do with the structure. And so F here is, I've just changed notation. So I put the G internal is E to the 3 delta times F, just to make it look nicer. So again, this flux, I can invert this, and I can write the flux in terms of the structure. And you also need to solve the Bianco identity and the equation of motion. So supersymmetry implies that the Einstein equations, implies the Einstein equations, but you must impose the Bianco identity and equation of motion separately. These are not implied by supersymmetry, but the Einstein equations are. Okay, so it's pretty horrible, and of course, the general solution to that is completely out of the question. But you can study special cases by setting components of intrinsic torsion to zero.
So there's no ambiguity at all?
No, it's fixed completely by the structure in this case.
So it's not like a general equation?
No. So before the 27, so this 27 component dropped out of this killing spinner equation. This is G27. So this doesn't happen here. So in the level-dimensional case, it's a 75. Okay, so this intrinsic torsion is completely determined by these conditions. So the details are in the table. So the idea now is that you can classify and analyze different types of solutions to those equations in terms of which components determine all. I.e. you can study particular cases. So you can solve these equations in particular cases, but the general case needs more work or smarter policy. So the nice thing about this intrinsic torsion is it allows you to go backwards in some sense. So I just told you that this intrinsic torsion is completely determined by the differential conditions that I just wrote down. So this implies that you can now construct a connection which satisfies the supersymmetry equation. And there's some mathematical work on this by these mathematicians. So in fact, Simon Salomon is also doing this. So it implies that these necessary conditions for supersymmetry I wrote down are also sufficient. Okay, so the idea is, and I will just go through a couple of examples, you can study particular cases and solve. And I'll do that in the next couple of instances. But before I do that, I just want to mention, and then go through. So if I set the mass to zero, so I'm considering now compactifications, and I mean real compactifications, or compact internal like three dimensions, R1, 2, then you can integrate the 0, 0 component of the Einstein equation. So this is implied by the supersymmetry condition. So you can either work out the Einstein equation, or you can play around with those supersymmetry conditions. And you get the following result. So it tells you that the fluxes have to be zero. So, and this is quite a generic result, so that generally there are no compact solutions with fluxes in general. when you have zero mass. And the way that you typically evade these theorems is by including high derivative terms. So even in the M2 brain case, it was this high derivative term involving x8. The angle of this was the angle of g squared. And this is a high derivative term. So that's the thing that saves you.
So were you saying it's sufficient? You said you also have to impose conditions on the flux.
So they're sufficient for supersymmetry, but you also need to have a solution to the equations of motion. You need to impose the Bianchi.
So what does this impose on the structure? If you require these equations?
Well, that imposes additional constraints as well. So I didn't write these down.
But there's no geometric interpretation. In terms of the structure, what the
question? It relates components of the structure to each other. I didn't write down all the reasons. Okay, so let me describe a few special cases where you can actually solve these types of geometries. So a simple thing I can do is to set the internal part of the flux to zero. And it turns out that this is equivalent to having, so in the intrinsic torsion, there are 10 components, and there were two singlets, so all I've got turned on here are the two singlets. So in this case, you can actually solve all the equations. So the vector here, the one-form vector, is related to the angle between these two spins. And this electric part of the flux is also determined by this angle, and so is the wall factor. So this drops straight out. So if you now rescale, so if you perform a rescale by the metric, and you rescale the freeform, turns out that this is actually just ADS4 across with a weak G2. So we've got an ADS3 solution here, and this extra angle, which is inside the 8-manifold, combines with ADS3 in such a way that you get an ADS4 slicing. And this equation here tells you that the 7-manifold has weak G2 homology. So what this means is that D of phi twiddle is proportional to star of phi twiddle. So examples of these things are the 7-sphere or squash 7-sphere. I mean, they're actually infinitely many of these known, and this was all studied in the 1980s in great detail. So there's nothing new.
Is this an M2
problem? Yeah, it's a near horizon limit. M2, a conical singlet. So you have a cone over a weak G2 manifold, which is a spin 7 cone. If you place an M2 at the tip of the cone and take the near horizon limit, you get these geometries. Okay, so there's another interesting situation we can consider, which is when the flux is self-dual. So this is the internal part of the flux on the 8-manifold. So again, so this electric leg of the flux is related to the Wolf factor, and the Wolf factor is again related to the angle, but in a different way to the previous transparency. And the flux is determined by the structure again, and this is generally true. The internal part of the flux is just given by this expression. And remarkably, you get conformally spin 7 manifolds. So in fact, there's a paper by, again, Beckers, and this is a student, I think, who looked at this case independently. So this is a sort of special case of what we did. And so they checked this solution in the case where the 8 manifold is flat. It turns out to be some deformed two brain, which was looked at by Svetich and Lu. So this is, it's kind of like the M2 brain solutions, and there's a spin 7 manifold sitting around, but it's a spin 7 manifold with particular properties, so it's got an almost product structure. So in fact, the only example we know is flat space at the moment, so it would be interesting to look at these and work out in more detail what the geometry is. So I can't tell you any more about this. So we also looked at some other solutions. So there's a dyonic membrane solution, which is like a bound state for an M5 and an M2. That's also in our class emission, that's a solution. There have been some dielectric flow solutions with Warner and collaborators, and that's also in this class, and we looked at that. And there's also a singular family solution, which is easy to write down. So, this is found in singular solution. So, in this case, the intrinsic torsion has one component. It's a singlet, which I called 1 prime in the energy transparency. So this is really, really close to just being flat space crossed with a G2 manifold. So if this wasn't here, I would just have a G2 manifold times R1.3. So this is very, very close to being this. It's just got one component turned on. And you can see the G2 manifold has survived. Yeah, so it's still sitting here. But now there's a radial direction, and this is horribly singular, right? And the flux is turned on in a very simple way. So there's also a limit in which you can recover this by scaling the proof. I have no idea what this means physically.
There are also solutions when you look at this old conic form.
That's right.
So you can make human resistance with the whole time space. They're all similar.
Yeah. So there are some examples where you can solve the equations, but in general, you know, it's disappointing. You can't get a general solution. But it's a systematic approach to the whole world. So let me tell you about generalized calibrations now and how it's related to what I was just talking about. So we call that a calibration on a Riemannian manifold, calibration on capital Y, is a P form which satisfies the following equation. So it's closed. And for every tangent P plane on the manifold, the volume form restricts to that P, the phi restricts to that P plane is less than equal to the volume form used by the mesh. So there are lots of examples of this. So, special harmony manifolds give examples. So on a G2 manifold, I have an associative 3 form and it satisfies these two conditions. So then a p-dimensional submanifold is said to be calibrated if this bound is saturated on all of its tangent planes. So it's very easy to show, I mean, it's a one-line calculation, to show that calibrated submanifolds where this bound is saturated actually have minimal volume, essentially just the same quality, within their homology class. So what this means is if I wrap a brain in one of these calibrated submanifolds, then it preserves symmetry. So that's the physics of what's going on. So supersymmetric brains in special harmony backgrounds are related to calibrated submanifolds, and they have minimal volume in their model. Okay, so this has again been known for a while. But this whole concept generalizes to arbitrary supersymmetric backgrounds with fluxes. I want to tell you how that happens. So, in general backgrounds with fluxes turned on, the brains, supersymmetric brains, will have minimal energy. So they won't have minimal volume anymore, because there'll be background fields and maybe world volume fields that turn on the brain. But they still saturate the calibration bound. And these G structure equations that I wrote down before are precisely calibration conditions. These generalized calibration conditions. So these supersymmetry equations that I wrote down, the differential forms, are precisely the conditions you require for a brain to be supersymmetric, to have minimal energy. So he worked this out in some detail in the papers. So I'll just quickly get through that. So consider an M5 brain probe in an arbitrary supersymmetric background of flux in M3. So I have at least one Killing square meter. So I'm going up a level here, and I'm considering the general case. So I just have some M3 background which has one Killing square meter. So the probe is supersymmetric if and only if some projection operator, which comes from Kappa symmetry, annihilates the spinner. So you can use this fact to write down the same bottom only bound. So this is a norm, so it's positive, and it's zero if and only if the brain is supersymmetric. So the idea now is to write down that Bogomolsky bound in terms of an energy bound. So it's quite standard how you do this. So I define the following bilinears just as before. So I can take the spinner in 11 dimensions and sandwich it between 5 gamma matrices, and I get a 5 form. And I can do the same with the 2 form. And these, in the language before, these define either an SU5 structure or this funny structure here, spin sign similar R8 and so on. And this was studied by Jerome Gordon and one of the students, Dennis Packers. So in terms of these forms, which you construct from the spinner, the Bogomolsky bound can be written in the following way. So in the literature, various things like this have been done before, but the general case hasn't been done, so that's why we have to use this. So this is how the Bogomolsky bound looks. I get 1 over the M5 brain tension here, and I get the energy density of the M5 brain tension, the energy bound, and that's greater than or equal to the pullback, so J here denotes an embedding map at the 5 brain. So the pullback of the 5 form to the world volume, so this is the 5 form to the 5 form on the world volume. And the pullback of the 2 form wedged with the self-dual 3 form on the 5 brain. So H here denotes the energy of the self-dual chiral 2 form. And then this last term here is a Wessimino-like coupling. So this is a curly C here, and this is supposed to be C. So this is a potential for the four-form M theory. So it depends on both this and the H. I didn't write out the form. So given this bound, and given a supersymmetric background, I can define a pair, so i.e. a five-dimensional submanifold in space-time, together with a 3-form as well. So the 3-form looks like the pullback of the empty C field plus the self-dual. So I can define a pair to be calibrated if and only if this bound is saturated. Okay. So now I have a background with flux and my 5-brain as a world volume filter. So this is very general situation. So then if you go back to the work of Jerome Gordon, he talks about this strings actually. They show that supersymmetry implies the following conditions on the form. So this is much like what I was talking about earlier with 8-manifolds. So D of the 2 form, so this is a 3 form here, is... So I can also construct a 1 form, which is essentially a time-like Killing vector, U and T. So it's a contraction of this Killing vector into a 4-form flux. And then D of the 5-form looks like this expression here. So using these facts, which come from the fact that the background is supersymmetric, I can now show that a calibrated pair, so this is a 5-brain world volume sigma 5, and a 3-form is world volume, have minimal energy within their homology class by using these conditions. So it's a calculation you have to do. And by homology class here, I mean that I identify a pair here, right on primes, if and only if these two world volumes are in the same homology graph, then the boundary orientations of some six dimensions. And I can also extend the three form. So this is a sort of generalized homology. So without going through all the details, I can now apply this to my case that I looked at earlier. So here are two of the equations that were written down, those horrible equations which were written on transparency earlier. So these are precisely calibration conditions for, so this is a membrane wrapping on the k direction, and this is a space-filling membrane. So these conditions ensure that a membrane, say a space-filling membrane, is supersymmetric. So that's the physical interpretation of what these equations are.
Did you derive from the Lorentz bank for the
two? It actually comes for free from the M5 brain. That's the remarkable thing. So you can also look at the Bogomolnik bound for the M2 brain, and you just get a subset of what you get for the M5 brain. So it's not surprising, because the M5 brain, in turn, a three form, reduces an M2 brain charge. So the membrane is completely contained in the M5 brain. Okay, so that's sort of the end of the main bit of my talk, but I just want to just sketch something that I'm doing now. So using similar techniques to what I just described. So this is current work with Jerome, Dan Waldron. So we're not finished, but we're almost finished. So our idea here was to look at alias 5 solutions to M theory. So these are interesting because they're dual to four-dimensional 64 and 4-3. So usually you look at alias 5 in type 2B. In fact, very little is known about alias 5 solutions to M theory. And there are only a couple of examples. So basically, now the scene and units. So I'll explain what that is. So our motivation is just to understand something about these solutions and possibly say something about the dual and four material theories. So we do much of what I did before. You make an ansatz, so there's an alias 5 part to the metric and then an internal 6 part. And now the flux will be entirely inside the 6 part. We can decompose the spinner, 11 dimensional spinner, in the 5 dimensional part. So if you make the same sort of ansatz that we described earlier, where you assume this is chiral, so remember from the eight-dimensional case, this led to M2 waves of solutions. In this case, if you impose that this is chiral on the six-dimensional volume, everything is pretty trivial. So the flux has to be zero, the warp factor is constant, and the internal space is collabular. So, and in particular, there are no Minkowski fire solutions. So this is just Minkowski fire. And it's easy to see this from this superposition. So to get interesting solutions, alias five solutions, we have to go to the normal bound. So this is very similar to what we had before. So the stabilizer now is SU2, and I can write down the following form. So this is a two-form constructed from the spinner. This is another two-form, and there are two vectors. So I'm going to skip straight to the conclusion without going into any details. So supersymmetry then implies the metric looks like the following, the six metric. So there's a four-dimensional part, and this is Kähler. So there's a Kähler form and a Bose here. There's a y direction here, which corresponds to one of the vectors. And the other vector is Killing. It's a Killing vector. So there's always a Killing vector. And that's not surprising, because in a dual CFT, there's a U1R symmetry. So it's fairly obvious that you should, from the alias CFT correspondence, you should have a Killing vector. You always do. So that's precise. And I think depends on the same. So at fixed Y here, as I just said, this is a Kähler form manifold, which means that D4 of J is the Kähler form of 0. But this four manifold is 5 over the y direction. And then this U1 direction is again 5 over the space. So it's quite a quite interesting geometric set. So the other two form is interesting. So the other two form you construct with the spinners depends on the killing direction. So the dp psi is a killing vector of the metric, but the structure actually depends on it. So this is quite interesting. We've not seen this before in this context. So what this means is, in terms of this U and R symmetry, this two form here is charged. And in general, we'll have some charge K. Oh, since this is a bilinear in spinners, it means that spinners have charge K in the two. And again, the flux is completely fixed by the structure. So you get some equation that says flux is just related to the structure in the flux. So this is very analogous to type 2b, but slightly more complicated. So recall that in type 2b, if you want supersymmetric solutions with an ADS5 factor, it means the internal space here has to be an Einstein Cesari number. So the simplest example is a 5-sphere, but you can also take the T11 space. And all of these Einstein Cesari spaces always fiber with a U1 over a Kähler Einstein space.
Can you remind us of what is an Einstein Cesari
number? Yeah, the simplest way to describe it is that if you take a cone on Einstein Cesari, then this is love, yeah. That's the easiest way to say it. So it has some killing spinners and stuff on it, which you can think of as doing a cone reduction of the killing spinner. So for example, a cone on a 5-sphere is flat, R6, which is 20,000. So these are 5 manifolds, always U1 fiber over a Kähler Einstein space. And that's very similar to the structure I just described. We always had a U1 fiber over a Kähler space, so in general it's an Einstein. And again, on these Einstein-Cesari spaces, there's a 3,0 form which descends from the 3,0 form on the Galois, and this is also charged up in the U1 direction. So the structure is rather similar, but slightly more intricate. So the simplest example is, I'd say, the Maldacena Luna. So this corresponds to the near horizon limit of an N5 frame, which is wrapped on inside on a cycle, H2, inside Calabi R3. So if you start with the Calabi R3 fold, you wrap an N5 frame on 2 cycles, you take the near horizon limit, and that gives you an ADS5 geometry. And their solution will just be here.
Sorry? Why are you saying that you want to move the ADS5? Where is the ADS5? Where is the model to move the ADS5?
It's ADS5 plus with the 6. It's ADS5 plus with the 6 solution.
Asymptotically, at least in type 2B language, as you go far away, what you see is this little chain scale. You don't see ADS5.
No, it is ADS5 plus. The solutions that I'm talking about is ADS5 plus with the 6.
I think what I was thinking of is non-conformal. That's what's confusing. The gauge theory is non-conformal. Is there some conformal solution of which it's
They have two different conformal solutions.
They are. Well, the thing I know is that two solutions, each of them is conformal. It's dual to NH1 and HC.
They are conformal. Their geometry is ADS5. I mean, there's solutions to the equations that we have.
It might be, terminal stress or sign of follow-up, there's the conformal case for the
I think you must be thinking about different solutions.
Yeah.
I discussed this with Carlos last week, so And he was interested in what we were doing. So, in their particular case, so I told you that this four-dimensional metric is Kähler, and in fact it's very simple Kähler model. It's just the metric on H2 times with the metric on S2, and there's some relative warping going on, which depends on the y direction. So there's an extra direction here. There's an extra direction y, which is not the Killing direction. And the two forms that get charged, and it turns out to have charge 2 under Killing vector, okay, which means the spin is charge 1. So you can compare this to type 2b on T11. So type 2b on T11 is an S1 fibered in T11 here, which is topologically S2 times S2. And then if you remove the S1 fiber here, you get S2 times S2. That's Kähler-Einstein. So in our case, we've also got an S1 fibered over a 5 manifold, which is now not S2 times S3, but H2 times S3. And then if you do the reduction on the S1, the Killing direction, which is the more asymmetric direction, you get H2 times S2. So it's a kind of M-theory analog of T1. So we've also found some other solutions that we're still working on. So it's still in progress. So I'm going to conclude now. So flux compactification, so doing on fluxes is something that's very interesting. And I'd say that very little is known about it generally. But what I just told you, this idea of looking at G-stress as an intrinsic caution, is a useful framework for studying properties. I mean, for example, you know, the supersymmetry restricts the form of the metric. So that was clear in the super last example that I showed you. So the old-fashioned way is to make an ansatz of the metric. But this is much more general. It's a more systematic approach of studying these sorts of solutions. So there's a lot more to be done. So it's clear that there are a whole new class of geometries thrown up. And generally, it seems that not much is known about these various classes. So, are there other examples, and what properties do they have? Can you talk about the moduli space of particular types of geometries with fluxes? I don't think anything is known about this. Similarly, this generalized calibration approach. So, on special homomy backgrounds, for example, Fourier threefold, if you wrap a brain over supersymmetric cycle, for example, special Lagrangian cycle, then you know what are the deformations of that cycle, so i.e. what the moduli space is. But for these generalized calibrations, no one knows. It's not the study. So it's also not clear what the relation is to Chris Hull's approach to this generalized topology. So it'd be interesting to look at that in detail. Also, it'd be interesting to look at how you avoid these no-go theorems by including hydrogen terms or including brain sources and so on. And then there's a last point, the superpotential. So in the more general solutions that I've been describing with fluxes, there should also be a superpotential in low energy theory. But it won't look like flux wedge calibration. You expect that somehow the generalized calibration enters into this form. So there's been a bit of work very recently in the last few weeks by some people appearing in particular cases where this formula here gets modified by these generalized calculations. So it would be interesting to analyze this further on the big picture.